This is Full Logic Reverse. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. We hope you'll stay tuned. Our guest is Kenneth Rahn, who teaches a course in the assassination of JFK at the University of Rhode Island. First, what I'd like to do is talk about how did you get involved in doing this?
Well, you know, I got involved almost the same way you did. It started, first of all, I've been involved for about 7 or 8 years now only. I have lived through the assassination, remembered, but was not particularly drawn to it for one reason or another. I think maybe I was too young and not thinking about political matters very much and so on. It just let it go. Then in the spring of 1992, that's 2 or 3 months after the JFK film had been screened around the holidays of that season, I saw a part of an interview on one of the local TV stations in Providence with Mark Lane, who was then pushing a book. He'd just come out with a book, Plausible Denial. I didn't particularly understand what he had to say, but I thought it was kind of interesting. Went out and got the book, read it, didn't understand it again, put it away for a while, because it's a lot of names and places and so on are thrown around in there. Then, a couple months later, June or July of that year, the Laserdisc version of Oliver Stone's JFK came out, and I have an audiovisual room at home with a laser player and a big screen television and so on. I bought the laser disc, watched it, and was very, very impressed by the movie as a whole, but particularly by the repeated showings of the famous Zapruder film in there, where you can see the car, the motorcade, and the presidential limousine, and you can see that when Mr. Kennedy is shot and when Connolly is shot, and then at the climactic end, when Kennedy is hit in the head, it's kind of gory, but it's important stuff, and you see the cloud of debris flying up, and then you see him thrown backwards against the seat of the car. That particular moment is used over and over in the trial scene at the end, where the Jim Garrison character says, back and to the left, back and to the left, and so on, meaning that there had come a shot from the front. So I became an instant conspiracist. I said, wow, that's really strong stuff. Obviously, if there was somebody shooting from the rear, which would be Lee Harvey Oswald, and if there's somebody shooting from the front up in the front right up in the, where the grassy knoll is, then two shooters makes a conspiracy. So then I sat on that for about a month or so. Then the scientific side of me started kicking in and said, watch out, that's only one piece of evidence. As appealing as it seems to be, you really ought to check it. My laser player at the time had a very good freeze frame function. So one hot August night, I decided, now's the time. I'm going to look at this Zapruder film frame by frame and see what I see. And to make a long story short, immediately on the first viewing of it, it was clear that what really happened was different from the portrayal in the film. Because you can see the head explode, and then you don't see it starting to move backwards for a couple of frames, 2 or 3 frames. Now, I didn't major in physics when I went to college, but I took enough physics that I know something about it. And if that were, if he had been hit in the head from the right front, that caused the big explosion, then he would have moved back instantly. It would have not have been something that would have been delayed for a little while. That was the first, then, of many enlightening experience that I've had in this crazy JFK assassination business. And that showed me that things are not always what they seem, and you really have to keep your wits about you.
And there's so many ripples that come off of the killing of President Kennedy that you explore. Let's talk about what some of those are.
Well, the course is divided into several different sections. We have it follows a broad historical approach. That is, we begin with the deed itself and some of the early reactions. I've become very interested in how people were reacting immediately after the assassination in that year before the Warren Report came out, because there were no official data on the table at that point You had only the stuff that came out in the magazines and the newspapers, and which amounts to basically gossip and innuendo. But there were people writing books on the subject, and there were people writing articles on the subject, and I say to myself, how can that be if nothing is official yet? So what you see then is people's predisposition, and you see people on the left, you see people on the right and the center, and they're all blaming one another and so on and so forth. So we have a historical section that goes through the deed and the Warren Commission, reactions to the Warren Commission, which is where we'll be shortly in the course, the leading up to the House Select Committee, the second big governmental investigation, and then a couple of other topics after that. We have 14 weeks to do the whole thing, and believe me, it's kind of a rush. We will come to sections on scientific topics of the assassination, which is something that's near to my heart, because I come from a scientific background. We talk about the physical analysis of the motions in the Zapruder film. We talk about the chemical analysis of the bullets. And I believe very, very strongly that unless people are familiar with some physics and some chemistry and some mathematics, that they're not in the position to fully appreciate this all-important physical evidence that was generated. We have a big section on critical thinking. You alluded to something like, you know, what can we know and how can we know it and so on. And so from the very first days of the class, I start trying to get the students out of their normal way of thinking and into the critical mode that is so important for this. As time permits at the end, we will have a section on what you might call higher criticism of the assassination, its place in history, how the works, how these hundreds of books and articles can be viewed as new types of literature. Some people say that the Kennedy assassination is the first example of a new way of generating knowledge, where this was something not controlled really by professionals in the field, but by this army of amateur sleuths that arose immediately after the assassination and are still working in full force today. And what happens when the average ordinary people take it over away from the professionals and the governmental officials? Does that inform the process? Does it degrade the process? Or is it a little bit of each? So this is a smattering of some of the topics that we go through.
Let me go back, if we can, to talk about, I know an issue, as you so stated, which is very, very important and central to you, is the issue of the physics, the chemistry, and the math of the deed itself.
Sure.
Talk, if you will, about that, and what can we know from that?
Okay.
Or what can we not learn from that?
Well, you know, my whole approach to the assassination is to understanding the assassination is that there are a few things that we can be very confident about, and I would say practically know with certainty. Those things are all based on the physical evidence. That represents a minority of the discussion about this, but it's exceedingly important minority of the evidence. Let me give you an example or two from the physics. What you see is, if you watch the Zapruder film at full speed, and the Oliver Stone's JFK shows, I think, seven times this the killing sequence when the head explodes and he's thrown backwards and so on. When you watch that at full speed, he's hit in the head, it explodes, and he goes backwards. When you watch it frame by frame, you see something else that I didn't get until a couple months after I viewed it that way the first time. There are, in fact, two or three different motions of the body. The first one that you absolutely cannot see full speed is the head snaps forward. And I've put on the website, I put those two frames between Zapruder 312 and 313. You can see before the head explodes, he's hit, and the head snaps forward by about 3 inches or so. Now, why is this so important? And I should say, only after another frame or two does the head explode. Why is this forward movement so important? Because ballistics, the theory of ballistics, tells us that a high-speed missile, a bullet, interacts with an organ of a body in two steps. And the first step is just sort of drills its way through. Nothing explodes. And that movement, that first movement, is the key to where the bullet came from. And the organ moves in the same way, exactly the same direction that it does when the bullet hits it. So Kennedy's head snapped forward. That means that the bullet was moving forward. That means that he was hit from behind. Period. End of discussion. There's no way out of that. This is one of those absolutes that are so, so important in this case. Then, during the next couple frames, the pressure builds up inside his head. It explodes, and stuff goes out in all sorts of directions from there, but it still tends to go preferentially forward. So, from the Zapruder film, we learn that the killing shot came from the rear. We also see that of the all the other movements, and there's two or three other movements or gradations of movements that the head and the body underwent, that none of those other ones are compatible with a second bullet. They're all various types of reactions to the first bullet. So he was hit in the head only once, and that shot came from the rear.
So while we can learn from the physics and examining that the shot came from the rear, that brings us not necessarily any closer to who actually fired the shot, though, correct?
Well, you then look for the next piece of data downstream, shall we say. The fragments from that bullet that hit him in the head were recovered. Two large fragments were recovered in the front seat of the automobile. They're the tip or the nose of the bullet and the base of the bullet. Together they add up to about 40% of the weight of the bullet. Each of those fragments, luckily, is large enough that they can be they can be traced to the rifle by the ballistic markings along the side. And both of them go back to Lee Harvey Oswald's rifle in the depository to the exclusion of all other rifles. So the next step is we can say that bullet that hit him in the head was fired from Lee Harvey's rifle, period. End of discussion on that one, too. Right? Now, there was another large fragment found, and that was in Parkland Hospital, that in the Oliver Stone JFK film, you see Jack Ruby sort of slipping it under the mattress on the top of one of the stretchers.
Right.
But in fact, it just rolled out from one of the stretchers. That's the so-called magic bullet or pristine bullet, and it's neither one of those things. It is nearly a whole bullet. It came from the body shot, and that was also traceable back to Lee Harvey's rifle to the exclusion of all other rifles. So, and when you look at the chemistry of the fragments that were recovered, they're compatible with two bullets, the same two bullets whose large portions we recovered. So, and those are the only fragments of bullets recovered in the assassination. So all of the physical evidence that we have takes you back to two and only two bullets that hit. That's one of the very important conditions that we have in then building up any theory of what might have happened.
We're talking with Kenneth Rahn, and we're talking about the assassination of JFK. And Kenneth Rahn teaches a course on this assassination, a crime that never goes away. Mr. Rahn, let me ask you then, I mean, can we go from what you are saying to saying that all of these questions and accusations about conspiracy and cover-up are invalid because the physical evidence points to this one rifle?
Not quite. There's a subtlety here that I want to point out. We have all the physical evidence that is validated out there. By that I mean can be studied by independent people, is consistent with two bullets fired from Lee Harvey Oswald's rifle. Now, when you try to go beyond that, you are then in unknown territory, basically. You're in areas where the evidence is not validatable, it's not really testable evidence, meaning that you don't really know whether it's right or wrong. The fact that we have two bullets from one rifle does not preclude there from being another shooter. There could have been somebody on the knoll, except there's no physical record of this person. They might have missed. I mean, I personally think there's no evidence that there was anybody else shooting. If you wish to suggest that there was, you have to come up with some evidence. And there isn't any. There hasn't been any for 36 years. Maybe there was a conspiracy with Lee Harvey Oswald. In fact, I can't even say that he pulled the trigger. But there's no reasonable alternative has surfaced in that time. So the evidence, the physical evidence that we have is consistent with either non-conspiracy, one guy, or conspiracy. but there is no specific physical evidence available for conspiracy.
When we're talking about physical evidence now, of course, we're talking in terms of the bullets and utilizing the physics and the math and the chemistry that you're talking about. But in looking at, for example, the Warren Commission report, and then also looking at critiques of the Warren Commission report, there do at least appear to be people who claim to have been witnesses who at the very least said they saw people, they were stopped by people claiming to be Secret Service agents, things like that. I mean, I guess maybe the first question to ask is, did the Warren Commission do a satisfactory job in investigating this? Perhaps first is the question I would like to ask.
Well, the Warren Commission, when you look at what they did with the short time available, I mean, they didn't really get going until January after the assassination. And in September, the summary volume was released, so that's 8 or 9 months. And in October, the 26 supporting volumes were released, reasonably thoroughly digested with a systematic point of view put forward, supported by the physical evidence and by a lot of the other types of evidence. From one level, you have to say they did, I mean, they worked their tails off. The staff just worked practically around the clock for that period. There was tremendous pressure, tremendous tension to get the story straight as well as they possibly could. From that standpoint, they did an outstanding job. Were there loose ends? Were there things remaining? Were there things that were not fully explained? Were there internal contradictions? Of course, when you're dealing with what did the FBI have, 25,000 interviews or something like that, there have got to be a lot of little pieces that don't fit. That's the nature of a human exercise like this. It is very easy with 26 volumes of supporting data to go hunting through there and find some pieces that don't fit the broad picture. They're all over the place. But that doesn't impugn the broad picture. That's not enough to say that the broad picture is fundamentally wrong from this. So, you know, you have to look at the report on two levels. On the one hand, it's an excellent job. On the other hand, it has quite a lot of internal contradictions, as any human effort would.
It seems to me, and once again, I mean, just over my sort of cursory examination of some of the major points and the major criticisms, I mean, it seems to me that when you have allegedly eyewitnesses saying, well, I saw these things, and then apparently, at least according to some critics of the Warren Report, there seems to be somewhat of a systematic exclusion of those witnesses, whereby, you know, I mean, witnesses that have a tendency to focus on what appears to be the lone assassin are included, but that there appears to be any number of people who are excluded who would give testimony contrary to that. I mean, are those invalid criticisms? Or
they're criticisms that have been voiced very frequently. Without getting into any specifics, I would simply say, I think one has to be kind of hard-nosed about this. One has to say, show me the physical evidence here. There have been people who said, for example, that they were standing in the grassy knoll or halfway up or at the top or at the bottom, and they heard bullets whizzing by their head, and they ducked for cover, they fell to the ground, and so on. And yet, when you try to carry that a little further and you say, show me the assassins that were up there, show me their picture, show me something from the gun, the rifle, show me the rifle, show me the bullet that hit from those things, there's nothing. When one is eyewitness to a very confusing event like this, an event that involves fear and panic and a great deal of unexpected violence, the brain does funny things some of the time, not all the time, by any means. I mean, I'm sure there are good, many, many very, very valid reports from there. But you have people, we have a lot of people who said they heard the shots come from the grassy knoll. They heard the shots come from the depository. They heard their shots come from other directions, or they couldn't tell, for example. So this kind of testimony is very difficult to deal with. And when people disagree like this, it's human. It's for the physical nature of those surroundings and so on. I've looked at, uncounted number of reports like this and pored over them and sweated over them for a lot of years. But what it all comes down to is the real difficulty of dealing with eyewitness reports in very stressful situations.
We're talking with Kenneth Rahn. Caller, you're live on the air.
Yeah, I was wondering, William, I think it was Garrison?
Yes, yeah. Jim Garrison, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Jim Garrison from New Orleans, yeah.
Is he still around and what happened?
Well, he died a couple years ago. He played a part, actually, in the movie. He was the Earl Warren character, of all people to have him play. He was the Earl Warren character in the film, but he died 2 or 3 years ago.
So did he leave any legacy or any heir to all his research? Because that guy was really deep into it.
He was into it. He had a lot of people working with him and for him. The files are largely still down there. They're in the possession, and I have not followed the Garrison part of this too carefully, but it seems to me I believe it's a district attorney down there. I may be wrong on that. It's Harry Connick Sr., the father of the piano player and singer.
Really?
Harry Connick, if there is a legacy, he's it down there. He has a lot of the files, and I think he doesn't want to give them up. This was some time ago, though.
So the government files can't be opened until...
Oh, no. A lot of them are being opened. There was a 3-year effort actually spawned by the JFK film. There was a whole agency was created called ARRB, Assassination Records Review Board.
Yeah.
Pushed governmental agencies to declassify a lot of these documents. They were, in most cases, needlessly classified at various levels, secret, top secret, that sort of thing. I mean, all the testimony at the hearings of the Warren Commission was classified top secret, I think, for a while anyhow. Several million pages of documents have now been released way ahead of time because of the work of this organization. It lived for 3 years. It's out of business for a year or so now. But those researchers are still poring over those documents. There's drawers and drawers full of them down in the National Archives, too, in College Park, Maryland. The interesting story, though, is with the millions of pages, is that there's, you know, the big breakthrough has not come out. The thing that people were hoping for in the beginning, the smoking gun, if you will, has not been found in those documents. After 36 years, one wonders whether it's ever going to be found. But people pore over those things daily down there.
Caller, thank you for calling
in. Yeah, thank you very much.
In the Stone film, much ado is made of this sort of area of New Orleans and Harvey Oswald's connections to all of these various types of people and organizations, alleged. In your study of all of this, does any of that pan out?
There's no doubt that Lee Harvey Oswald spent time in New Orleans. He had family, had relatives down there. He spent part of the summer down there before the actual assassination. His wife sent him down, and after he tried to kill General Walker in Texas, he used the same rifle to try to kill this retired General Walker, ultra-right-wing guy from the Birch Society and so on. Took a pot shot through a window at him. Walker moved at the last minute. The bullet careened off part of the window, and he was saved because of that. The Dallas police never solved it. His wife, Marina, sent him down to get him out. She didn't want him taking any more shots and getting in trouble with that. So he spent a few months down in New Orleans that summer. There's no doubt that he was involved in some activities, like, for example, creating a local chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, which he was the president and the only member of, passing out thousands of leaflets on the street, not getting anybody to join, and so on and so forth. The offices apparently were in the building that was shared by some of these other strange groups down there. The problem is going beyond that. I don't know what to make of any of this. I'm not sure that anybody does. And now we come back to the beauty of the physical evidence. Even if there had been some connections like this, it did not result in a second shooter. You know, it did not result in anybody rescuing Oswald after the assassination and taking him out of the Texas School Book Depository. What did he do? He walked out the front door and caught the first available bus, for example. You know, you can put what we say in science as boundary conditions around this from the physical evidence. And there are all these theories that are out there There may be something to some of them, but they're fundamentally untestable and unvalidatable, and they're not going to go anywhere until somebody comes up with something concrete, which nobody has.
Carla, you're live on the air.
I was wondering if the bullet that was found on the stretcher in the hospital, was there any evidence that that was the bullet that caused the injuries to Kennedy and Connally?
Yes, there is. There's some very strong evidence. This is an area that we haven't gotten into yet. It's the chemical stuff that we talked about at the beginning of the show. That bullet is known as CE-399, Commission Exhibit 399. It's the so-called pristine bullet or magic bullet. It is the bullet that, from all the available evidence we have, passed through the two men's bodies. It was fired. It was the first of the shots that hit. Fired from the Lee Harvey's rifle on the sixth floor, passed through Kennedy, entered at the top of his back, came out his throat, and then went and passed through Connally and gave him several wounds, and eventually wound up in Connally's left thigh, where it penetrated to about half an inch or so and fell out and so on. Now, in the process, it left a piece of lead in Governor Connally's wrist. That piece, or actually there were two or three little pieces, were extracted from his wrist in the hospital, turned over to the FBI, and were analyzed for their concentration of certain tracer elements. It was the element antimony that was used. It was analyzed twice by the FBI and by Vincent Gwynne later on, some years later. And that, the concentration of that element in the wrist fragment overlaps or matches what's in the bullet that was found on the stretcher. And that's the proof, or virtual proof, very close to proof, that the bullet was actually shot that day and was not some sort of a plant. The other, Vincent Gwynne later on, some years later, and that, the concentration of that element in the wrist fragment overlaps or matches what's in the bullet that was found on the stretcher. And that's the proof, or virtual proof, very close to proof, that the bullet was actually shot that day and was not some sort of a plant. The other fragments involved that are related to the headshot, that's the one of the two large fragments found in the front seat of the automobile, the fragments from Kennedy's brain and three little pieces of lead found underneath Mrs. Connally's seat in the rear, they all match with one another with different levels of antimony, and that represents the other bullet that was the headshot. So it all ties together very, very nicely.
We're talking with Kenneth Rahn, and we're talking about the assassination of JFK, of which Mr. Rahn teaches a course at the University of Rhode Island. Mr. Rahn, let me ask you this question, because, I mean, there certainly are any number of people who it appears, make a fairly decent living off of conspiracy theories regarding JFK, correct? I mean, there's lots of them.
Unfortunately so.
Why is it that this incident has created so much of that?
You know, if I could answer that, I could go on television and win a million, I think. I don't know, but I have some thoughts on it, at least. The first thing is that here we have, what should we call him, a sort of beautiful, charismatic president, cut down in his prime, in his youth. The course of history in our country got changed. That was the beginning. That was, you know, after that was in the middle of Vietnam business, which escalated after that. People began to lose faith in their institutions and so on. Then we had the two other assassinations after that. So that the Kennedy assassination, in a way, marked the beginning of the long period of disillusionment of the American populace, whereas before we had trusted our president and our governmental agencies. Now we don't trust them so much. It all goes back to that. And the other thing is, discussed by William Manchester, he said, author William Manchester, he said that the scales of justice in this thing don't appear to balance. On the one hand, you have the marvelous President Kennedy and all everything that he represented in Camelot and all that, and we know now it wasn't quite as much Camelot-y as it was before, but still, this the government and the splendor that government can be on the one hand, and this little cheapy, mousy guy, Lee Harvey Oswald, who worked for a dollar quarter an hour, couldn't hold a job for more than 6 months at a time ever in his life, fired off a couple pot shots and brought that whole thing to a close. The scales of justice don't quite balance. Can it be that one little guy could do so much to the whole country? Then 2 days later comes Ruby out of nowhere, shoots Oswald. Can it be that Ruby is possibly acting on his own? That's what tipped a lot of people's minds also. But I think we have to be really, really hard-nosed about this, and we have to look at the data, not put theories first, but put the evidence first and see what direction they point us in and how much they constrain us, and then we get a very different view of the assassination. And I think it's highly likely that that is exactly what happened, strange as it seemed.
We've been speaking with Kenneth Rahn about the assassination of JFK, and Kenneth Rahn teaches a course in this subject at the University of Rhode Island. Mr. Rahn, we just have about a minute left. I hate this because there's so much more I'd like to talk about.
I know. We're just getting warmed up.
I know it, and perhaps we can have you on again. Is there just a quick final thought for our audience today?
Don't take things at face value. Concentrate on physical evidence. That's the thing. Don't deal with evidence that's uncertain. If you allow into your intellectual system, shall we say here, evidence that you're not sure about, you will necessarily come out with conclusions that you're not sure about. The key here is starting with evidence that you know is sound and give you see how many conclusions you can draw from that that then will be sound, right? And then maybe as a later step you can put in all this weaker evidence, but if you do, watch out.
Kenneth Rahn, thank you for joining us today to talk about the assassination of JFK, and if we can, we'll have you on again.
Well, great pleasure, Mike. I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you.
Right, bye.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of the program today. I'm your host, Mike Thornton, and it's been my pleasure to be part of the team bringing you Full Logic Reverse. If you'd like more information about FLR, you can contact us via email, flr@jps.net, or by telephone, 530-271-0804. We invite you to join us next time for another edition of Full Logic Reverse.